From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gerlot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. This half hour, Rebecca Cruz talks with energy analyst Andreas Goldtau. He says if Europe embraces technology like hydraulic fracturing, it'll reduce the reliance on Russian oil and natural gas.
Or do we actually accept the fact that we will retain high dependency on a supplier that's not very reliable?
But first, Joshua Landis joins me to discuss Syrian President Bashar Assad's surprise visit to Moscow this week to brief Russian President Vladimir Putin on both current and future military operations in Syria.
Russia is trying to bring Assad out of isolation. They need to get him back on the stage and get the world to take him seriously.
Energy and the global political economy, plus the future of Syria's civil war, right after this hour's news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gerlot. Joshua Landis, let's do a Syria update because big news this week. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad traveled to Russia. This is the first time that he's left the country since the civil war began in 2011. He went to meet with President Vladimir Putin to coordinate military action in Syria, which, of course, Russia is now playing a significant role in that conflict. But this is what are the consequences of this? This is a significant move on the part of President Assad and of course, Russia's involvement there.
It is a significant thing, and it's not just about PR. Russia is trying to bring Assad out of isolation. They need to get him back on the stage, the world stage, and get the world to take him seriously. The United States has said he's got to go. All the European countries said he had to go. And Russia, now that it's moved its military force into Syria, it's pounding the rebels, is trying to find a permanent place for the Syrian regime. And that's going to be a very hard sell with the West. But that's what they're trying to do, is get Assad back onto the stage with some legitimacy.
So trying to rehabilitate him in some way. I mean, is that really going to be possible?
Well, you know, you think this is a big Russian machine. Everybody's been impressed with their new power. But the United States is playing a very coy game. They don't like Russia there. On the other hand, they don't know what to do because their own policies have sort of ground to a halt. And I think, you know, listening to Kerry and listening to the president, they think Syria is going to be a swamp for Russia. It's going to get stuck. So Russia thinks it's going to reconquer the whole country, probably won't be able to. And perhaps in a year, as they get sucked into that swamp, they're going to come back on bended knee and look for a deal. And I think that's where both Kerry and the president are waiting till the time is right. And perhaps the Russians can be helpful in delivering Assad and creating some movement towards a political solution for this.
So Russia, let me get this straight, Russia's trying to broker a deal between Assad and the West by engaging in military action and coordinating military activity in Syria.
I mean, that's true.
I mean Russia's getting something out of it too, right? I mean, it's not just trying to broker a deal between Assad and
Assad
the West.
Was getting weaker and weaker, and the West's policy was Assad will get weak enough to some point that he'll just offer any kind of compromise. The Russians don't want him to collapse. They want a foothold. So they've gone in saying, this is our client. You can't do this. We're going to be his sponsor. So they're pounding the rebels, weakening them up, and thinking they're going to get a better deal. And that's the question, is we're watching the balance and power going back and forth in Syria. And the increased Russian presence is causing more refugees to come out.
Now, a couple of weeks ago when I was in Istanbul, I spoke with Ferhat Demir about what we were seeing in Istanbul. Last week in Izmir, I didn't get a chance to talk about the refugee situation there because of the bombing that had happened in Turkey.
City.
But it's a coastal city, and that's where all of the refugees are heading, to the coast, of course, to try to board rafts and boats to try to make their way to Europe. And so it's definitely, I reported that we saw a huge presence in Istanbul. You can't miss it. You can definitely see it in Izmir, too. It's a little more hidden during the day. At night, you see people starting to gather, interestingly, just along roadways and in the medians of roadways. They're gathering. You know what they're doing. They've got their black bags filled with belongings, mainly things like waterproof phones. There's been this whole market that's cropped up in Izmir. It was very interesting. Sony phones, because they're waterproof. waterproof have really experienced a huge growth in sales there. And life jackets, we've reported on that before, that that life jackets have really are much more visible in Izmir. But sadly, things like fake life jackets are being sold. I learned that while I was there. I mean, you know, that they're women, children, kids, you know, that are wearing fake life jackets when they get on boats to make their way to Europe. So it's a very troubling situation. You can definitely feel the tension. That combined with, of course, the protests that were going on in Turkey after the bombing in Ankara, the Turks really seem at a loss of kind of what to do. So, all right. Well, thank you so much, Joshua, for being here.
Pleasure.
And giving us your insight as always. We'd love to hear your thoughts about this discussion and answer any questions you might have. Send us a tweet at WorldviewsKGOU or contact me at Suzette Gorlot. You can find regular updates, articles, and photos from Joshua Landis and his blog Syria Comment at Joshua_Landis. After a short break, we'll hear Rebecca Cruz's conversation with Andreas Goldtau. He's an energy analyst and professor at Central European University's Department of Public Policy, who studies security and the political economy of energy markets. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot. We're joined today by Andreas Goldtau. He's a professor at Central European University in Budapest and an associate at Harvard's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs. His research focuses on energy security, the political economy of global markets, and governance issues related to global oil and gas trade. He spoke with our contributor, Rebecca Cruz.
Andreas Goldtau, welcome to Worldviews.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you're an energy specialist, a political scientist by training, but an energy specialist in that regard. And you wrote earlier this year on the international oil markets or energy markets, commenting, of course, that there's been a significant downturn in the last year, that we got used to about $100 a barrel for oil. Now we're looking at maybe half of that. What's going on here? I mean, we go to the gas pump and we tank up, and for many of us, it's pretty exciting that we're not paying as much, but there are consequences to that, and there are consequences here in Oklahoma, but certainly on an international stage as well.
Well, indeed. We have seen a period of time where the $100 oil was the new normal, and that's what people thought. And obviously, that wasn't sustainable. There were a number of factors that kicked in, including a surge in production in the U.S. That's the unconventional oil production here, plus a staggering economy in Europe, less growth in China, and some strategic decisions taken by Saudi Arabia and OPEC. And all of that gets us to a $45 barrel oil situation. The question now is, what are the implications of all this? And I think there's three elements that play an important role here. One is we'll certainly see a change in the industry. We'll see a change in the American oil industry. They have started to kind of become innovative on the technology front. They cut costs, but still the question is out, you know, is that enough to sustain the unconventional oil revolution in the U.S.? And the call is still out. We'll see. The other thing is, what do other producers do? That's Saudi Arabia, that's OPEC, that's non-OPEC producers. And some of them have been hit hard by lower oil prices because production costs are as they are. So they don't necessarily cover costs anymore at certain price environments. Which brings me to a third point, which is, you know, some countries rely heavily on oil and oil revenues. And those are the countries that are hit hardest at the moment. That includes Venezuela. That includes a whole bunch of countries on the Gulf. And the reason why they are hit so hard is because the social price that they need for oil is way above the market price that they get. Some countries need a price of $100 or $110 to get their budgets balanced. And we're obviously, you know, a far cry off from that. Here, the question really is, how do those countries and economies deal with that situation, and what implications does that have for societies there? These are open questions, and, you know, the next couple of months, half year, will tell us exactly where we're going.
Well, maybe we could try to at least think about a couple of those. What are some of these countries that are dependent doing? What are they trying to do to make up that, as you say, the social costs as opposed to the market costs?
Some countries try and set this through. Saudi Arabia, for instance, simply declared that they will keep on pumping no matter what. There's a strategy behind this, and obviously they're trying to target the American shale industry. Saudi Arabia is in kind of a positive or simply or still kind of good situation, and that's because they sit on vast reserves of foreign currency. That's because they don't have a lot of state debt and sovereign debt, and that's also because they, you know, they have invested massively in programs that for now keep people happy on the ground. Other countries don't necessarily have these deep pockets and sit in a lot more debt. One of the countries that indeed has a big problem at the moment is Venezuela. They have made a couple of mistakes in the past. They have turned, you know, a functioning oil company into the social policy arm of the government, which is not a good idea, obviously. But they also have funded social policies based on debt and with a view to sustaining high oil prices, which were not as sustainable, as we know. There's not a lot those countries can do. Venezuela is on the brink of bankruptcy, really. They're on the verge of collapse. There's a couple of other countries, including countries on the Gulf, that kind of pursue a mixed strategy. On the one hand, they're trying to cut back on social expenditures, on military expenditures. On the other hand, they're trying to kind of sit this through with some adjustments in the oil industry. One of the main problems that, or a similar problem that all of those countries have, is that essentially the regimes in those countries and the governments in those countries, they rely on an implicit social contract, mm-hmm. which is, you know, essentially they tell the population that we keep you happy, we make sure, you know, you have all the social benefits that you want, we give you good education, and but you leave politics to us. Essentially, that's the way they sustain their authoritarian regimes. Whether that's going to work out in the future with oil prices around 45 or less, that's a big question, simply because they're almost incapable of bringing down the social costs of oil that they need to sustain that model.
Our guest is Andreas Goldtau, an analyst based in Europe who studies the politics of the global energy trade. After a short break, we'll hear more of his conversation with Rebecca Cruz. I'm Suzek Rolat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzek Rolat, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. We're joined this half hour by Andreas Goldtau, a professor at Central European University in Budapest who focuses on geopolitical issues related to oil and natural gas. He's been speaking with our regular contributor, Rebecca Cruz.
Is this what we need to get used to, $45 a barrel? Is that kind of the foreseeable future?
There's this old saying in the oil business, which is, if you forecast, forecast often. It is hard to tell. I think there is differing voices out there. On the one hand, you have people from the finance sector that keep on rambling on about $20 oil. That may or may not be the case. Then Eni, the telling company, came out with a projection a couple of days ago that would suggest that we're back at $60, you know, in a year's time. So obviously you have a span in between. I think what will likely happen is that prices will go up. And that's simply because the low price environment will take its toll on the production side, on the supply side in the US. In other parts of the world where you have high production costs offshore, so the market will react, but we will not be back to the $100 oil anytime soon. That's simply not in the cards given the international economic situation, which doesn't look good, neither in Europe nor in China nor elsewhere.
One of the other countries that obviously has been greatly affected by this, as well as some geopolitical situations as well, is Russia and Gazprom, their state-run company there. It's interesting because Russia really seemed to escape kind of the global economic crisis of 2008, 2009 because of oil. And here they are significantly struggling with that and sanctions and some other things. What is the future of the oil industry there? Has Europe been able to become less dependent on Russian oil, or is that a situation that's going to continue as well?
I mean, there's a couple of things. First of all, Europe is as dependent on Russian oil as it has ever been. I think Europe imports about 75% of its oil from Russia. That said, it's not a big deal, simply because we have a global market. It's a fungible commodity. And even in the event of a supply crisis, Europe will get oil from elsewhere. The much bigger question here is gas, really, because gas is a regional game. It's not a global game. You have long-term contracts. You have pipeline infrastructure that ties a producer and a consumer into long-term relations. And if those relations sour, you actually indeed have a supply problem. You don't necessarily only have a price problem. And here, the Europeans have tried to kind of get their acts together, but they're not even halfway, I would say. There is a move towards something that's called the Energy Union right now, which would try and bring various elements of what still is a scattered EU energy policy together into a common framework. And the idea is essentially not only kind of to secure supplies elsewhere, but also to make the internal energy market robust, which means you need to integrate that market. You need to kind of make sure that pipeline infrastructure is in place and reverse flow capacity. And, you know, you need to bring regulation, you know, on a level playing field and all that. If that works out, the European situation looks a lot better than it did in the past. And that's not because the share of Russian imports in European gas goes down, but simply because the whole system is more robust against supply shocks. So I would argue when it comes to oil, the European situation isn't that bad. When it comes to gas, there's still a long way to go. Turning to the Russian domestic situation in the oil sector and the energy sector, I think there's a couple of factors that we need to bear in mind. One is, yes, the oil price has come down, but at the same time, the ruble has fallen, which gives you an interesting situation because most of the expenditures in the Russian budget are denominated in ruble, not in dollars, which essentially means that once the oil price came down and the ruble exchange rate came down as well, you have a situation where it almost balanced out in the budget. The budget essentially is not greatly affected. What's more important probably is how the Russian oil industry will react to the sanctions. And this is the bigger issue, I think, because what happened is that the Western world essentially targeted the core of what constitutes the Russian economy, and that's the oil sector.
Right.
So they're deprived of foreign technology right now, and obviously the oil industry is a very integrated industry. It's not a national industry. So you need foreign technology, you need partners, you need service companies, you need certain companies with certain skills for offshore drilling, for shale drilling, and all these kind of things. And once you cut a company off from that, the company has a problem. So even giants such as Rosneft, which is Russia's biggest oil company, it's state-run, even those giants, they will face some bottlenecks and very, very soon, actually. And on top of that, they're deprived of money, of capital, because they're cut off essentially of international capital markets. So what I think is going forward in the next couple of years, we will essentially see a situation where the Russian oil industry will be choked. And that will affect how the industry is run, its effectiveness, its ability to tap new resources, to maintain production, and all that. So slowly but surely, we'll see some decline going on in the Russian oil industry.
And that's a result of sanctions, of the cutoffs, as you mentioned, as well as it seems that the energy market seems to be cooperating with us in those efforts, I suppose. Obviously, we can see where the energy sector is related to national security, international security, and obviously where it's also related to environmental concerns. Are there policies that they can put forward that acknowledges the environmental consequences, the security interests, as well as their national interest for making revenue off of the energy sector?
Right. I think I think what's very important to bear in mind is that energy is not a commodity like any other. It is a traded commodity. It has a price. It's a private good, essentially, but it has public goods characteristics. So that's what we call the negative and positive externalities stemming from energy production and consumption, including positive externalities for national security or the economy, negative externality for the environment and climate. And that makes energy a strategic good. And that's exactly why it's so difficult to regulate that good. Also, why it's so interesting to look at that in academic terms. The question really is, how do you strike a balance between those goals? And countries and nations have found different answers to this. In America, you can argue that the answer was put business and the economy first. I'm painting with a very broad brushstroke here. Subsoil resource rights sit with individuals. You have stories such as the farmers a farmer turning into a millionaire, you know, and that's exactly because regulation was geared toward a very simple goal: extract it, make money of it, market it, because it has positive externalities for the economy and national security. Obviously, there are mechanisms in place to hedge the negative sides of things, and so you have the EPA in the US, you have state level regulation, but I think one can still argue that that the energy sector retains a very important role in the entire kind of regulatory environment in the U.S. In Europe, that's very different. You have, let's say, environment-focused regulatory regime, and that's part of the history because the place is a lot more populated, and you know, and the history in the extractive industries is not that long in Europe. So the choice that European policymakers have taken is essentially to put environment first. For the better or the worse, the energy economy is not as pronounced and important in Europe as it is in the U.S. That comes with downsides. It comes with downsides on the energy import front, on the energy security front. That's exactly what we've been talking about. So you could, for instance, make the argument if the Europeans would import the fracking technology and deploy it widely in Europe, because you do have shale gas reserves, you do have shale oil reserves in Europe, then they could actually wean themselves off of Russian import dependency. So the trade-off here really is, do we want to do that and you know, mess up our backyard and essentially, you know, deal with flowback water issues and all the things that have come up also here in Oklahoma,
of course,
earthquakes and all that? Or do we actually accept the fact that we will retain high dependency on a supplier that's not very reliable? And this is a trade-off that that I think every country and nation has to decide and deal with on its own. There is no silver bullet, no one solution.
Well, as you say, obviously the energy sector is an international sector. We are all connected, so we will continue to watch and see how we go forward in this situation and see if you are correct and that the energy prices stay at the level that we're estimating right now. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a great pleasure.
You've been listening to Rebecca Cruz's conversation with Andreas Goldtau, an energy analyst and professor at Central European University in Budapest. He's also an associate at Harvard's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs. You can follow him on Twitter at Goldtau. And if you visit KGOU.org, you'll find a link to his blog on energy affairs. KGOU produces Worldviews alongside the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Sam Dupre and Brian Hartzinski produce the show, and Ivy Dyson serves as our digital content intern. For Rebecca Cruz and Joshua Landis, I'm Suzette Gorlott.